Welcome back to season three of Snubs and Dubs, where we're talking about the snubs and dubs of the 74th Academy Award for Best Picture. I'm your host, Kyle Tobias, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Jason Miller. Jason, how you doing?
You know what, Kyle? It has been a minute recorded, but I'm feeling good back in the couch saddle, ready to go right back on the flow. How are you, Kyle?
I'm great. It feels weird because I've been on a trip. I was in New York. And I'm back, and I feel like I've been back like a substantial amount of time already for me to feel like mostly settled back in. We haven't like even talked about that on the pod yet. So here we are.
It's talked to you since you came back. So to me, you were here, like you got back 5 minutes ago. That's all, for all I know, that's true. But then you told me about having a work week and I'm like, oh yeah, you were here.
I've been here. Yeah, no, it's been weird. But anyways, New York. Mm-hmm. Last week we talked about how I watched Beetlejuice because we were going to see Beetlejuice, and I thought that might be the only play we saw, but we ended up seeing three Broadway plays.
Kyle, which was hit absurd. Us with them. What were they? How were they?
So the first one we saw was Beetlejuice, and it was fucking amazing. I love every second of it.
Kyle is wearing a Beetlejuice shirt, and there are various Beetlejuice mugs scattered throughout the house. But please continue.
And Beetlejuice was the only one that I actually bought, like a shirt afterwards, because this is like, it's like a nice shirt.
It's a nice shirt.
Yeah. It's just kind of plain. We've got the Beetlejuice logo on it, and all the other shirts for the other shows were kind of like, I don't know, a bit strange, like not something you would just wear around. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, viewers at home, it's a nice shirt.
Yeah, but it was a really great show, and like they had awesome production design. Like they had one of those weird snakes from the movie, like the sandworm things. Yeah. Like they had like a real practical one of those, and they did a lot with like practical effects and costuming and just like cool stage effects and the lead actors, which it departs from the source material a decent amount in that the large focus of the show is not on the main couple that dies. It's on Beetlejuice and Lydia.
Interesting.
And I think they made a right decision doing that because they are the two more interesting characters of that.
Yeah.
And I was okay with the main couple kind of taking a back seat, but it did kind of change the story a little bit. Not in some ways where like it completely derailed it, but just in the ways that like allowed for more focus on those characters. Mm-hmm. And there's not the whole traveling to the other realm and seeing the counselor sort of thing, like their caseworker, like that's all cut, but then instead you get a whole plot of like Beetlejuice and Lydia and their relationship. Mm. It was great. And the actor that played Beetlejuice, and I think he's been playing Beetlejuice since Beetlejuice has been a play on Broadway, is just, he's so funny. It's so good. And I think it was the funniest show that we saw, because the other two shows we saw were Harry Potter and the Cursed Child and Aladdin.
Neither of them noted comedies.
Yeah. And this one was like surprisingly adult in a way, like the way that they would joke about things, and there was a lot of swearing. I was actually kind of surprised because you'd think it might be a kid's show, given that like the movie is, I mean, it's not like necessarily young kids, but
it's kid approachable.
Like, whereas this one, there was like all sorts of swearing and just like a lot of adult humor. And it was, I really appreciated it for that, but it was a little bit surprising. So I'd say if you're going to New York, definitely see Beetlejuice. Or if it comes to your area, definitely see it, because it was fucking great. Harry Potter was also really good. I know that there have always been some complaints about the writing of it, like the source material of The Cursed Child. I understand some of the complaints. Like I texted you after, I was like, Jason, it was your favorite plot device. And you knew right away.
Time travel
movies.
Yuck.
So it was a time travel focused play. Acting was good. The actor that played Draco Malfoy's son Scorpius was a little over the top for me in a lot of ways, but I guess that's kind of how he was written. I don't know if the actor was really given it or if that's just how he was directed and written to do it, but everything else was good. I really enjoyed the visual of it. Like obviously they did their best to make it feel like it was in the wizarding world. There was a lot of wand effects and just really cool visual, like fire and flare and lights and everything. And it's not a musical, so there was no music, but they did still have kind of like flowy dance elements and stage transitions, but it was mostly just like kind of a drama play.
Interesting.
It was pretty cool. I enjoyed it. And lastly, we saw Aladdin, which I was happy to have rewatched the original cartoon a few weeks ago. So it was kind of fresh in mind. But that was also a really good show. Like, it's a Disney put on production. Mm-hmm. So it was going to have some like pretty extravagant spectacle and great songs. And obviously, a lot of the songs are ripped straight from the original movie. But then they added a bunch of songs. The actor who played Aladdin was really great. And obviously, the actor that played the genie, they're big parts of that. Jasmine, for some reason, she has that like classic Broadway voice that can sometimes feel a little shrill kind of grainy. It was clearly a beautiful voice. It just started to get to me a little bit, but she wasn't a large part of it. And for some reason, so many people were talking during the show.
What the hell?
And it wasn't even the kids. Like, there was kids that were there. Obviously, it's a Disney show, so very safe for kids. But the kids were just like watching in awe, and they had the magic carpet ride. It was beautifully done. But like, when they did that scene, especially the magic carpet ride, all these adults were just like chitter chattering around. I'm like, wow, how do they do that? Oh my gosh, it looks, and it just completely takes you out of the magic of the moment. So yeah,
brutal. Oh man. Dang adults in Aladdin. Unbelievable.
But yeah, that was a good play. I think if I were to rank them, Beetlejuice far and beyond number one, then maybe Aladdin, then maybe Harry Potter.
Interesting. So, yeah. But all enjoyable times in New York?
All good times, yeah. And then other than that, like, we saw Billy Joel in Madison Square Garden.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
It was fucking cool. And Olivia Rodrigo was there randomly. So
tight. So you were at the show where she was singing with
you? I was, yeah.
Oh, that's wicked.
Yeah, that was there.
How did it sound live? Because I heard some people kind of ripping on Olivia Rodrigo for her vocals during that.
It was okay. Like, I had heard Olivia Rodrigo live, as in like I watched her on a video live before, and it sounded basically the same.
Okay,
as her,
yeah. Well, that's good.
So, yeah.
And she's taking some flack. I didn't know if it was deserved or not.
I don't know. I think people are probably being a little cruel, especially because like nowadays songs on like the radio, especially these pop songs, are so tuned
so
to like
produced.
The very perfect note. And so she's still got a beautiful voice. I just think maybe have the expectation because they know the song so well. And then when they hear it live, they're like, oh, she's a little off there, but like it happens with everybody.
Yeah. So stop talking hate out there. And if you're in Aladdin, stop talking in general.
But Billy Joel was in to kind of contrast that. I was so surprised because he was amazing, like vocally. And there was even points where like he was like, oh, I wrote the song as a younger man. And even when I wrote it, I was kind of going away with high notes, but I decided to do this one for some reason. So if I don't hit it, you know, just know that it's been a while. But he hit it and he was fucking incredible. And like we also saw Elton John here. Mm-hmm. And obviously Elton John has had some throat issues before. So like his voice now is a lot deeper than what he was when he originally wrote some of those songs. And so he sounds different. But for Billy Joel, for some reason, he just sounded like exactly
as it was.
Yeah, it was incredible. So
that'd been a great show to see.
Yeah. Did you watch anything else?
No, I haven't watched anything. I went on vacation. I was down in Sundry playing disc golf.
Nice.
No movie watching there, but I did watch myself play disc golf poorly.
Well, that's good. I skipped to you because I realized I should stop talking for a little bit, but I did actually watch some movies in the last few weeks as well. I'll do a quick run through.
Hit it.
When we were in New York on the last day, we were just kind of waiting for our flight to leave. So we saw Beast, the Idris Elba versus a lion movie.
Oh, interesting.
It was interesting. It was kind of fun. It was short, like 90 minutes, not any longer than it needed to be. He fights a lion, probably should have died, but he was okay. So if you're looking for a good background movie, it's probably a good background movie or just like an easy one to go to for easy entertainment, not having to think about it. I was quite impressed with some of the filmmaking of it because they chose to do a lot of long takes, and I was really impressed by that. Sometimes you don't really realize like when the cuts are happening if you're just kind of in the flow of the movie, but I started to realize like how much they were just keeping the camera on these people and letting it kind of flow, and it was really well done in that regard. And the way they utilized the lion, like the lion obviously is a CGI lion, but like he looked great, and they managed to hide him in certain ways too to make it not so apparent that it was a CGI lion.
Interesting.
But yeah, so they did. They really worked with what they had, and what they had was pretty good. So yeah, we also watched Cha-Cha Real Smooth on the plane, the new Apple TV Plus movie. A lot of people were like, oh, this is this year's Coda. It's this year's Coda. It's not this year's Coda.
Like, look, there can never be another Coda. Yeah. First of all, step off.
Yeah, I get it because it's like a light-hearted, somewhat emotional movie about like young adults going through like a transitionary period in their life, but it's not to the same extent that Coda was. And maybe because I had heard that, I had better expectations for it because I was kind of mild on it at the end of it, but it's still like a fun, easy time. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't see myself recommending it over things like Coda or other things. Yeah. You know?
Coda is lightning in a bottle. You're not getting another Coda. Yeah. Apple TV, try as you might.
And the last thing, on National Cinema Day, I went and saw a $3 IMAX showing of Top Gun Maverick for the third time.
Oh, hell yeah. How was that?
It was fucking rad.
Good as ever.
Really was. I was kind of humming and hawing about going because like there's not much in theaters right now.
There isn't.
Yeah, I was thinking about 3,000 Years of Longing because that's like George Miller's new movie.
I've heard that one's like worth seeing.
Yeah, but like if it was $3 for every ticket, and I could go to a regular cinema for $3, or I could go to an IMAX screening for $3.
Do the IMAX.
I went with the IMAX. Yeah. And so on a whim, I kind of went to a 12:30 showing of Top Gun. And it was packed, actually. And people fucking love that movie, including me. So
it's not the kind of thing you'll ever regret doing.
Yeah, no, totally. But that's it. That's all other than this movie.
This one.
Of course, season 3 of Snubs and Dubs is covering the films from the year 2001. And for episode 5, we're finally talking about a nominee for Best Picture. It is Gosford Park. Had you seen it before?
Heavens no. I've never even heard of this before. What is this? Have you seen this before?
No, but again, I also had heard of it. Just maybe in context of the Academy Awards, though. I didn't know really anything about it, though.
No, this is the kind of movie that, like, maybe if I had seen these award shows, I would have been like, oh, I've never seen that movie before. And then when it never gets mentioned again, I don't think about it again.
Totally, yeah. I see a lot of people online comparing it to like Downton Abbey, which makes sense. I haven't seen Downton Abbey, but it seems like it's kind of the same vibe. But obviously, both have Maggie Smith, so it's easy to kind of make that comparison. But yeah.
I will say kind of, maybe this is one of the fun facts. I don't remember. Mm. Downton Abbey originally was supposed to be a spinoff of this.
Interesting.
They decided not to go that way, but they are those two pieces of media are heavily linked.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, if you're interested in Gosford Park, I've included links to the physical media related to it in the show notes. If you buy through that link, it'll help out our show. Or if you have any other Amazon shopping to do, follow the general link to help out our show in the process. Reminder that this is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you haven't seen Gosford Park yet and you want to, go ahead and do so. I've also included time codes in the show notes so you can skip around to your heart's desire. But without further ado, let's get into it.
Gosford Park is a 2001 satirical black comedy mystery film. Not being British royalty, I may have missed some of the satirizing and comedy. it is directed by Robert Altman and written by Julian Fellowes. It's not based on anything, but it is influenced by Jean Renoir's French classic, Les Règles du Jeu, or The Rules of the Game.
I just see in the opening credits, it said based on an idea by Robert Altman. So he might have given the idea to the writer who then wrote an original screenplay.
This is starring everyone, including Eileen Atkins as Mrs. Croft, Bob Balaban as Morris Wiseman, Alan Bates as Jennings, Charles Dance as Raymond Lord Stockbridge, Stephen Fry as Inspector Thompson, Michael Gambon as Sir William McCroddle, Kelly MacDonald as Mary McCrochran. Probably pronounced that wrong.
Yep. I didn't even attempt it in my plot reading. I just said Mary.
Mary. Dame Helen Mirren as Mrs. Wilson, Jeremy Northam as Ivo Novella, Maggie Smith as Constance, Countess of Trentham, and a recurring Snubs and Dubs actress, Emily Watson as Elsie.
Also, Kelly MacDonald reoccurring from Trainspotting.
That's true.
Yeah. I was trying to place her for a little while. I was like, I've seen her before.
Yeah.
And there it was.
There it was. That wasn't even all of the main cast in the credits. I cut it down to the names that I remembered.
Yeah.
This has a runtime of 137 minutes and was released on December 26th. 2001. I did see a lot of dates. I saw like it had some festival play in like November and then was released in the United States in like January. So I don't know what release that was on December 26th, but that's what Rotten Tomatoes said. Sure. So we're running with it. Kyle, what do you think of Gosford Park?
What a fucking snooze fest. I was so bored.
Yep.
And the thing about it is there's so much potential in it too.
Yeah.
And I made the mistake of reading that it was a mystery satire.
Oh, you messed up by getting because, that in your head.
Like, I was like, where is one, the mystery, and two, the satire? Because like most of the time, I don't even know if I cracked a smile except when Maggie Smith did something delightful for a few seconds.
Yeah.
Like, and the mystery element of it was so deflating. Like when Stephen Fry shows up, I sat up a little bit. I was like, okay, maybe we're going to put some life into this movie. But no, it doesn't. It like almost is like in your face about it too, because he's so incompetent. And yeah. Like, I get the writing of an incompetent detective. And then you have the other, like the constable who's like, you know, a little bit more competent. He's like, oh, maybe we should look at this. Maybe we should do that. And I get that dynamic, but also like, it just didn't work for me in a lot of ways.
No, like, I'm glad I didn't know anything going in, because I think it let me give it more rope, not knowing that it was supposed to be a murder mystery at some point. Yeah. Although I picked up on it when that Hollywood dude is like, I'm writing a murder mystery and I'm basing it off this dinner party.
Yeah.
Like, okay, someone's dying.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it never, I didn't get any of the jokes. There were a couple.
Mm-hmm.
The Countess of Trentham, whatever, she had a couple zingers.
Yeah.
That might have been it. And even then, I think she was only written to have a couple zingers. But like,
yeah.
There were times where I felt like maybe someone said a joke. But even rewinding to re-listen, I couldn't figure out what the joke was. It just had the right candor of a joke.
Yeah. And like, they underutilized so many characters, I found. And that's just on them having so many characters.
There were so many characters.
Helen Mirren is like hardly in this movie.
Which is a crime.
Yeah. And because like, and she gives like a great performance at the end, which is why I know we'll get to this eventually, mm-hmm. but she was a nominee for Best Supporting Actress.
Correct.
But like on that, like that was maybe 5 minutes of screen time, and most of it, she was just stern.
Yeah.
Like, and I get that there's a lot of hidden emotions behind that character, and you realize that as you go through the story, but like, what? I don't know. And like I mentioned Maggie Smith before, she was the only bit of like life and energy that I would find sprinkled throughout it. And it was just on her sassiness.
Yeah.
When somebody spilled coffee on the person beside it, she just like bursts out laughing. It was just contagious laughter.
Yeah.
That was all it was. And then like one of my favorite jokes that she has is when the actor is playing the piano.
Oh yeah.
And she's like, don't clap. You'll encourage him to do another one. Like that was great. But like, she's not in it enough.
No, they had so much going on. Like, even though it's 137 minutes that are all pretty boring, it's also dense.
Yeah.
It is dense with plot lines that I never fully understood, trying my best, mostly because every time they talked about someone, I had to like think between the 30 other characters of who that was supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I did my plot reading before we did this section. We're about to get to that plot reading now, but there were plot lines in here that I'm reading that I had no clue were actually in the movie. Like there was parts of it that I was like, oh, okay, there's something going on there between these two, and then there's money, you know, problems there. But like the amount of depth that I read through, there's so much more to there than I think was telegraphed. And maybe it warrants another viewing, but I could not put myself through another viewing, at least not right away.
That's a lot of 137 minutes right there.
But yeah, maybe we should just get to this plot, because at least people will know what it was that we were dealing with.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read straight through the plot. Well, I already did. I've already telegraphed. If you don't need the refresher, you can skip right to the discussion by following the time codes in the show notes. But here's Gosford Park. In November 1932, wealthy English industrialist Sir William McCordle, his wife Lady Sylvia, and their daughter Isabel host a weekend shooting party at their country estate, Gosford Park. The guests arrive, Sylvia's sister Louisa and Lavinia, and their husbands, Lord Raymond Stockbridge and Commander Anthony Meredith, her aunt Constance, Countess of Trentham, the Honorable Freddie and Mabel Nesbitt, actor Ivor Novello, and American film producer Morris Weisman. Also, latecomers Lord Rupert Standish and Jeremy Blonde. Mrs. Wilson, the housekeeper, assigns the visiting servants to their rooms and takes notice of Robert Parks, Lord Stockbridge's valet, who mentions being raised in an orphanage. Head housemaid Elise guides the inexperienced Mary, the new maid to Lady Trentham, through the gathering. Following dinner, a silver carving knife is missing. Henry Denton, Weisman's valet, raises the staff's suspicions with intrusive questions and has a late-night sexual encounter with Lady Sylvia. Isabel asks Elise to speak to Sir William about hiring Freddy, who is blackmailing Isabel over their affair and her aborted pregnancy. Freddy mistreats Mabel, whom he married for her money when he overestimated her wealth, while Rupert courts Isabel. Lady Trentham confides to Mary that Sylvia and Louisa cut cards to decide which of them would marry Sir William, whose fortune, earned in business and thus despised by these aristocrats, was nonetheless necessary to sustain their father, an earl, and themselves. When the men go pheasant shooting at the next morning, a stray shot grazes Sir William's ear. The ladies join them for lunch, and Sir William withdraws from Meredith's business scheme, leaving the commander financially ruined. Lady Sylvia informs her Aunt Constance that Sir William may halt her allowance, on which the grand lady is entirely dependent. During dinner, Lady Sylvia berates Sir William, and Elise comes to his defense, inadvertently exposing their affair. Elise leaves the room disgraced while Sir William abruptly exits to the library. Mrs. Wilson brings him coffee, which he knocks away, demanding whiskey, which he calmly serves him despite this typical Shirley manner. The guests gather in the drawing room as Novello plays the piano and sings, with the servants listening outside. Freddy, Anthony, Robert, and footman George each slip away. One of the men, seen only by his trousers, puts muddy big shoes, apparently been waiting there to be cleaned after the shooting, over his own ones to pretend somebody came from the outside, retrieves the missing knife, and enters the library, where Sir William is slumped in his chair and they stab him. The body is soon discovered, and the bumbling Inspector Thompson and competent Constable Dexter arrive to investigate. Henry visits Lady Sylvia for another trice, despite her husband having just been murdered, and is revealed to be an American actor posing as Weisman's Scottish valet as research for an upcoming role in a Charlie Chan movie set in England, which Weisman is researching via this visit. It's discovered that Sir William was poisoned before being stabbed, and Mrs. Croft, the head cook, tells her staff about Sir William's history of raping his female factory workers. Those who became pregnant were forced to give their babies up for adoption or else lose their jobs. Isabel gives Freddy a check, which he angrily tears up when confronted by Mabel. Inspector Thompson releases the guests without interviewing most of the staff. Mary confronts Robert, deducing that he became Lord Stockbridge's valet to gain proximity to Sir William. Robert reveals that he is the illegitimate son of Sir William, who gave him to an orphanage 2 days after his birth, and that his mother, one of his factory workers, died soon after. He tells her that he didn't poison Sir William, and she tells him that he couldn't have killed him because he was already poisoned to death. Robert, by this time, has already discovered that his murder attempt was actually merely stabbing a corpse. He grabs and kisses Mary, who leaves right after. After the guests and their servants depart, Freddy, his blackmail scheme of Isabel having failed, pursues a partnership with Anthony, whose business venture has ironically been saved by William's death. Isabel overhears Rupert callously dismissing his courtship of her when he hears the limits on her inheritance. The fired maid, Elsie, accepts a ride to London with Weisman, Novella, and Henry. Lady Trentham and Lady Sylvia discuss Mrs. Croft and Mrs. Wilson's long-standing feud, leading Mary to realize Mrs. Wilson is Robert's mother. She confronts Mrs. Wilson, who reveals that she and Mrs. Croft are sisters. They both had children fathered by Sir William while working at his factory. Mrs. Croft kept her baby and lost her job, though the child died in infancy, while Mrs. Wilson gave Robert up. Realizing he was her son and that he intended to kill his father, Mrs. Wilson poisoned Sir William to ensure Robert's only crime would be stabbing a dead body. Mrs. Croft confronts the heartbroken Mrs. Wilson, and as Mary says goodbye to Robert, saying nothing about his mother or the murder, and the last guests go their separate ways. But that's Gosford Park.
That was a lot of plot. That was a plot. That was dense plot.
That was like the thickest plot I think I've had to read in a long time. Like, since we started to do more of the trimmed plots, like, oh my God, was it ever dense. And like, if I were to try and like actually take my experience of this movie and put it down into writing, I would not have had everything that this plot gives up, because I don't pick up on half of the stuff that is apparently happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just like it's on the writing for one thing, but it's also on just like the lack of screen time for each character, like we've said before, the plot, and the fact that all of these relationships and conflicts don't get enough time to flesh out or like get enough work where the audience can actually pick up on what's going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to one point, like maybe they wanted the audience to kind of just be plopped into this world and just observing these characters as they go through this upper class party. I don't know what it even is. Like, it's a shooting party, I guess.
Yeah.
And go through and like see the character interactions. But then like, you get completely lost. And I think what we were missing was a point of view character, because for a part of it, Kelly MacDonald's character is that.
I kind of thought she was going to be throughout the movie. Yeah,
but then she's only the point of view character for the servant side.
Yeah.
And even that doesn't get thoroughly fleshed out, because it mostly focuses on her relationship with Elsie, Emily Watson's character. Mm-hmm. And their relationship is fun. And like, you see them gossiping about stuff, but like, it's just so dense that like, I just don't know where to pick up, or like, I'm not internalizing everything. And yeah, some things they're saying that might be important or just kind of casually mentioned, but then they go on long conversations about something that's not important. And I don't know. It's it was wild.
I feel like, yeah, there is a lot of storylines that probably do add some depth and intrigue to the movie.
Yeah.
But they're mixed in with a bunch of things that never go anywhere. Yeah. Like, why is Stephen Fry's inspector a clueless character? Because he never solves it. He's not needed for this. He doesn't really add any comedy.
Yeah.
And I had a feeling that he was maybe supposed to be a comedic relief character that just wasn't funny in the scenario. And there were other things, like when Sir William got shot when they went shooting, that doesn't go anywhere.
No.
And they talk about it afterwards, but it doesn't result in anything happening.
Yeah.
He just gets shot at while shooting.
And the trouble is I think they did that to maybe put the more of a question in people's mind as to who actually killed him, when I don't think there was really ever a question after you start to realize where like the parentage and the lineage is. It is clearly Clive Owen's character.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, it never really seemed that complicated.
No.
Or it never was made out to be that complicated, because they put the clues in there and they're like, oh, you know, what's going on here? Like, maybe it's this person, maybe it's that person, or they shot them, or there's a knife missing. What's going on? There's like having an affair with one of the maids. Maybe they're involved. I don't know. But like, it never really tries to dissect all of that too much. And I was interested when the murder was happening, because there was like five people that went away. And
yeah.
We're like, oh, okay, so maybe we're going to get to a point where like any of these people could do it. But I don't know. I just never trusted Clive Owen's character to not be that person. And there was another quick moment that clearly was put in to maybe sell that, wherein when he's grabbing the knife, they take it out of that orange tin.
Fire or something. Yeah. Something. Yeah.
And later he puts a cigarette into the tin just very casually. And so I figured, I was like, okay, well, he's very aware of that being there. So like, clearly, that's him, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. What did you feel about the mystery?
I didn't realize we were going to get one until we were in there. But well, when they're mentioned, they spend a lot of time talking about the missing knife. So clearly the guy who raises the question of where that knife is, it's not going to be him. So making it look like the butler doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that when it came down to it, I was pretty sure it was the valet of Lord Stockton. Like the question was, but then who poisoned him? And then they tell you that one too. And I guess there is probably a way you could pick up and have guesses as to who it would be, especially that scene when that Mrs. Croft, I think it is, or is that the sister?
Yeah.
The lady who ends up poisoning him.
Yeah.
She goes to talk to the person who is her son, and that's a very awkward scene. She sees the photo, leaves in a hurry. So you could put together that maybe she would be involved in that, because you know he's a stabber. One thing that I really want to point out is when she says, like, well, it's not a crime to stab a... It is a crime to stab a corpse. It is, first of all, conspiracy to commit murder.
Yeah.
You can't just come that short of a technicality without doing prison time for that. But it's also desecrating a corpse. Whether or not you knew it was a corpse, you were doing everything in your power to murder someone. That is definitely illegal.
That I didn't really give much thought to that. Like, it did come into my head that that doesn't seem like it's that much better.
No, like, it's not safe and fine, good family fun. You still tried to kill a guy.
Yeah. Kelly MacDonald's character is like, it was a corpse. It doesn't matter anymore. You're like, you're kind of free and clear. It's all good. No,
absolutely not how that works.
And it's funny you mentioned at the start there, like, you didn't know it was a murder until it happened. Doesn't happen until an hour and 20 into this movie.
Yeah, I was really losing it. I did not know what this was about at any point. I thought maybe there'd be more to do with like talking about financing projects and movies because they had the business in South Sudan didn't go anywhere, but this movie's being made. Turns out, nope, it was none of that.
Yeah, it's so odd. But like, at the same time, it's still like competently made. Like, obviously Robert Altman cared very deeply about this material. It's got a cool location. All the costuming is really great. This score is okay too. And obviously everyone who's in it is giving their all with what they're given. And most people in it are very good, like very delightful to watch. It's just like, there's not enough there to really attach to any one character.
No.
Even Kelly MacDonald's character, who's supposed to maybe be your POV character, you lose track of her sometimes. Like you start focusing on other people, and then like you will eventually go back to her, and then you're like, okay, well, who am I supposed to actually sympathize with, and who's the focus here? I'm lost.
Yeah, I feel like I understand now why they wanted to make Downton Abbey to be like this, because this probably does better as a longer run TV series than it does as a movie where you don't have time to flesh anything out or really get to know all the characters. Like if you pop quiz asked me to name even the top 15 most screen timed characters and what their names are, I would do abysmally poor. I would maybe get 5 of them because I don't really remember. They do a decent enough job when a person's on the screen to know what their general thing going on is, but it's so hard to follow all the lines. And it's not the kind of movie where I would go back and get enjoyment from trying to follow different things because I don't really want to watch this again.
Yeah, no. And if you are not invested enough in the characters after a first viewing, you're not going to be motivated at all to go back and maybe find these little intricacies or actually kind of grasp onto the small plot threads that are happening interpersonally within these characters. Because like, why would you want to do that? It doesn't make sense to go back if what your first experience was poor. I don't know.
But I'm curious if in Britain, just people having secrets is a really hot, spicy drama that is beloved. Because we watched in our first season that one movie about British people keeping secrets that was also highly acclaimed. What was that called? I can't remember.
Holy shit. I'm like completely blanking.
Secrets and Lies.
Oh, right.
It's like the same pace of a movie, maybe weirder because it's more like there's more going on in it and you need to bust out a whiteboard to follow all the different plot lines. But clearly, like, they're very similar movies, just different time periods, but like vibe-wise, very similar.
Yeah, I think just like with Secrets and Lies, like it was at least easier to focus on the characters because there was only like 7 of them, maybe?
Yeah, no, it had a realistic, understandable amount of people in it.
Yeah, whereas this is just, it's too much. And like, I do agree. I think a TV show is probably the correct form for this story because it's too much for even 2 hours.
Yeah, no, it's, you can't get it all in there.
And it's actually funny because I watched an interview with Stephen Fry, who was talking about Robert Altman and this movie. And Stephen Fry said he had a conversation with Maggie Smith early on after they did like a read of the script. And she asked him if he understood what was happening in the screenplay. And he was like, I don't have a clue. And she's like, well, if you don't have a clue, then where am I supposed to figure it out? Yeah. So I guess even like some of the actors didn't really know what was going on. Yeah.
This is the kind of thing where these are a lot of big name actors who took pay cuts to be in this movie because they wanted to be in a Robert Altman movie.
Yeah.
This seemed like something that would get them some acclaim, but like, it did get the Best Picture nomination. Yeah. And it is a very competently made movie. I really enjoyed the costuming and design that went into like the art direction of this is really, really good.
Yeah, like you cannot argue with the quality of filmmaking on display here. It's just story-wise, it's
kind of a mess.
Yeah, well,
do you want to get other people think reviews? About
it? Yeah.
Well, the Rotten Tomatoes, we have a bit of an audience critic kind of spread going on. Critics given this an 87%. Audiences, 78%.
Okay.
I get it.
I still think that's even like higher than maybe I expected, but
same with me.
Yeah.
IMDb is giving this a 7.2, whereas Metacritic is giving this 90. They love this movie.
Holy shit.
At the box office, it was there. It made $58 million on a budget of $19.8 million, so it made some money back.
Yeah, not bad.
Not a smash hit, though. What is nice, though, is that at the box office, this was number 69. One of them had to be. Nice. But let's get to our scoring, which I think is going to be an interesting time.
Yeah.
Kyle, enjoyment time for Gosford Park.
I gave this a 2. I think for the most part, I was pretty mild on it. Occasional Maggie Smith enjoyment moments, but overall, it's a 2.
I gave this a 2.5. I think story-wise, I'm right there with you, but it was a well enough made movie that it did keep me in it more.
Yeah.
And all the performance, like it just felt like a really great movie without the movie part to it. It was weird. What's your craft?
See, that's where that argument is coming from me. I give this a 4 for craft because I think it is very, very well made.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going 4.5 on that bad guy though, because I feel like it is a very, very well made movie.
Yeah.
Probably how it got into Best Picture contention.
Totally.
It just had the most muddled story. Execution.
I give this a 3. There's a lot going on. All the actors were really, really good. I think that's what's boosting the score up for me. But because of just like the messiness of it, it can't reach any higher than that. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of people working in the background gave this everything they had. Yeah. And Kyle, what is your rewatchability?
It's a 1. I cannot really picture myself watching this again. I don't know what circumstance would drive me to do it. So yeah, it's a 1.
I agree. I can't imagine anything that could bring me back to watch this one again. Well, Kyle, that's going to bring your score to a 10 out of 20 for a 50%. Whereas I'm giving this an 11 out of 20 for a 55%.
Yeah.
Now, I have an idea of where this might end up in our pretty shallow rankings so far, but as a recap, Kyle, your rankings are Memento, Ocean's 11, Harry Potter, and Spy Kids.
Yeah, well, if the score was not any indication, this is going to the last place spot for me currently.
I will be joining you down there as well. My ranking will become Memento, Harry Potter, Ocean's 11, Spy Kids, Gosford Park. I feel like this is going to be similar to the Theory of Everything, where it just kind of keeps getting bumped down.
Yeah, I was excited for this one, too. I didn't know what I expected, but I kind of had the idea of like a fun British drama comedy. And like, I just didn't deliver on that.
No,
and I was a little disappointed because I wanted this one to be good, especially, you know, being a nominee for Best Picture.
Yeah. I'm not surprised that this one did not hang around the pop culture on its own right. Mm. Downton Abbey has had a much larger effect than this movie did.
Totally.
Funnily enough. All right, fun Letterboxd review time. This has a Letterboxd score of 3.6 out of 5. There were some good reviews. There were a lot of people actually, there was good discussion going on in the Letterboxd comments. So not a lot of people taking quips, but there were a couple decent ones. Dirk H, 4.5 stars. The best directed, superbly acted, stunningly scripted, intelligent, socially satirical, and most beautifully shot cup of Earl Grey I've ever had.
That's good.
Marta Louvi, 3.5 stars. So Dumbledore was a quite little bitch back in his day, hey?
Dumbledore? They couldn't even get McGonagall right? Wow.
Yeah, they put Dumbledore's. Was Dumbledore's actor even in this at all, either of them?
No, I don't think either of them were.
They must have meant Maggie Smith.
They probably meant McGonagall.
Yeah, God, that's good. Max Power, 2.5 stars. Bloody boring. Okay, I gotta try and go British accent. Okay,
I'm ready.
I apologize. Bloody boring. A bog standard who done it in it. What is bog standard? Was that crafted for this review? Because that wouldn't surprise me, but it'd also be even less surprising if that's just something British people say.
I think I've heard bog standard before, so I think it's a British thing.
Oh man, crazy place. And last one, this is the last good one I could get, by Louis Jean Antoine Depardieu. No rating. Not my white ass needing a flow chart for this.
You honestly do though. What the fuck?
It was okay. So Amazon Prime has that like X-ray thing where when you like move the mouse, it shows you who's on screen at a time. That actually helped for this one, and I had to check a couple times because I couldn't get all the dudes right of who was who. So I had to take a quick look to see which actors were on screen, so I know who it was supposed to be.
Oh my god!
Well, for awards details, this is where this movie shines.
Yeah,
this is nominated for 6. Academy Awards. We've talked about a couple of them. This has a nomination for Best Picture, also Best Director.
Yeah.
2 Best Supporting Actress nominations for Helen Mirren and Maggie Smith. This also has a Best Original Screenplay, Best Art Direction, and Best Costume Design. It only won one of these, Kyle. What do you think it might be?
Costume design?
No, Best Original Screenplay.
The part we like the least.
A couple of these. Best Art Direction, sure. Best Costume Design, sure. Best Supporting Actors, not big parts, but they were great.
Yep.
Whatever. Best Original Screenplay for the 2001 Oscars.
Okay, yeah, that's coming back at the end
of
the year.
That was footnoted for me, too. We have room to edit.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
For other notable awards, it's got quite a few. This got BAFTAs for the Best British Film and Best Costume Design, Golden Globe for the Best Director, Screen Actors Guild Award for Outstanding Performance by a Female Actor in a Supporting Role for Maggie Smith, and Outstanding Performance by a Cast in a Motion Picture.
Yeah.
It's also got the Writers Guild of America's Best Screenplay. So multiple people said this was the best of the best of screenplays.
I mean, I get that there's a lot of writing clearly happening here. And
there's a lot of screenplay.
The fact that people would need a flow chart to understand what is happening in this movie clearly shows a lot of effort went into the writing of this screenplay.
Yeah.
And so craft-wise, maybe, but also like if people are not enjoying it because of the complex nature of it, I think he lost as like a screenplay there, because at the end of it, movies still got to be enjoyable even if they're complicated.
This feels like a movie that was made for the actors and the people writing it and not for audiences at large.
Yeah, kind of a circle jerk Oscar sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. You want to hear some interesting facts?
All right, hit me with those interesting
facts. Strap yourself in. The camera is always moving in every shot.
Oh,
we're starting with a heater.
Well, I mean, you know what? I didn't necessarily realize that, but now that you mention it, it does kind of clicks. Yeah.
And tracks. This has been stated already, but Downton Abbey was written and created by Julian Fellowes, which is the writer for this movie, and was originally planned as a spinoff of this movie, but instead was developed as a standalone property inspired by the movie set several decades earlier.
Interesting.
Yeah. In the DVD commentary, producer and director Robert Altman stated he included the F word several times on purpose to get an R rating because he didn't want kids to see this movie. Yeah. He thought kids wouldn't like the movie, so he wanted to keep them out. You needed to do a bit more to keep out everyone who didn't like this movie because we watched it. The jewelry worn by the upstairs ladies in the movie was all authentic and had to be escorted in by armed guards each day.
Holy.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's also some like original artwork that they had got for this. Like they put a lot of effort into the costuming and design.
Yeah. Good. Good. They got award nominations for it at least.
Yeah. Now, last one. There is no animal rights tag in the closing credits of this movie. This is because the shooting scene was filmed with real birds and they were really shot.
Oh, God. I kind of had a feeling like when I was seeing that, I was like, there's no way that it's that realistic.
Nope. Right?
I mean, because, yeah, it was real.
Because they were murdering birds for that.
Yikes. Yikes, yikes.
Oh, that is a bit of a yikes. I wish they had shot me instead during that movie. Yeesh. <Oof. laughs>
Well, any final thoughts on Gosford Park?
No, I think I'm going to end on I wish they shot me instead of the birds. Yeah. How about you?
No, I think this is easily going to be one of those, maybe like A Secrets of Lies, where you mention a British film in two seasons time. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Well, I want to thank you all for listening to season 3, episode 5 of Snubs and Dubs. As always, you can find us everywhere on social media at Snubs and Dubs. That's on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Letterboxd, etc. We're also on Good Pod, so make sure to check us out there and join our official Discord. We'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on Gosford Park or on this episode, so please send us a tweet or a message with a question, recommendation, or anything else. I'm also at Kyle Tobiasen on Twitter, and Jason is at Windy_Mills. Of course, all of those links will be in the show notes. Make sure you leave a 5-star review, share the show to everyone you know, and check back next week for another episode. Here's a sneak peek of the film we're going to talk about.
Sometimes I think I might be going crazy from sexual frustration.
You just hate every single guy on the face of the earth.
That's not true. I just hate all these extroverted, pseudo-bohemian losers.
You guys up for some reggae tonight?
That's right. Next time we're talking about Ghost World, so make sure to watch it before next episode. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. Thanks for listening. That's a wrap. Bye.
Bye for now.